DW, Living Planet, with Sam Baker.
Welcome to Living Planet. Summer is a time of sun, sea, and sand. But sand isn't just the stuff of beach holidays. We'll hear how it's being used in East Africa and with what impact later in the show. We'll also pay a visit to a town in Italy inundated by cruise ships. And join a scientific expedition studying warming temperatures in the deep ocean. So whether you're on your summer holiday or dreaming of one on your commute, stick around. Between 1 and 3,000 tons of plastic are estimated to be floating in the Mediterranean Sea. While Lebanon only boasts a tiny fraction of Mediterranean coastline, the country makes a pretty significant contribution to its pollution. Two of its landfills sit directly next to the sea. In 2015, uncollected waste piled up to a critical point in the Middle Eastern country. Grassroots protests broke out against the government, with people demanding better waste management. But the country has struggled to find solutions ever since. There have recently been efforts to clean up Beirut's beaches. But do they symbolize a new era where Lebanon's government actually listens to the environmental concerns of its citizens? Or are they just a shallow PR campaign? Julia Neumann has this report from the beaches of Beirut.
At the sandy beach in Zouk Masbeh, north of Beirut, around 200 people gather, not to swim, but to collect plastic bottles, textiles, and microplastics.
The sea is our face. It's a shame that we're going to pollute it. We are polluting it. But however, we can do something, which is try to clean up, try to provide awareness, try to remove these plastics that were on the sea and not keep them there.
That's Richard Hanna. He's not just a citizen. He's the advisor of the Environment Minister of Lebanon. The ministry called for volunteers to clean up beaches. And according to the ministry, 7,000 people cleaned 120 spots along the seashore. The beach in Zouk Masbeh is surrounded by private resorts. It is one of the few beaches where the public can still swim. It is here where Jocelyn Kehdi started to collect waste 4 years ago.
So I'm Jocelyn Kehdi. I'm the founder of Recycle Lebanon and the Bala Plastic Movement. I started on this beach. I quit my job as the waste crisis happened, and I decided to mobilize the people exactly here 4 years ago. But to be very factual of what's happening with the waste today, all of this waste is rejectable. None of this waste can really be recycled today. Why? Because it's been inside the sea, it's been under the sun, it's been eaten, it's been deteriorated, and the recycling facilities all over Lebanon and all over the world will not take it, and that's one of the reasons why 9% of the plastics globally are only recycled.
A lot of parents came to volunteer, picking up waste and teaching their kids how to recycle.
I'm trying to teach my children that in the future there is still hope. We start by segregating the garbage at home, and then the government should provide relevant solutions for each part that is segregated.
We finished one bag here!
While waste has been piling up in landfills for decades, the poor handling of waste management became a crisis in 2015. The huge Name landfill site closed. Uncollected waste blocked streets, creating alleys of rubbish bags and waste mountains on riverbanks. It was then illegally burned down by municipalities. Protesters took to the street, calling out government corruption and mismanagement, demanding a sustainable solution. 4 years later, is the Ministry of Environment finally listening to civil society's call? The advisor to the Environment Minister, Richard Hanna, has this to say.
Well, minister has been in the ministry for 3 months, a bit less, so finally is a bit harsh of a word. He was listening since day one. He's always listening.
Activist Jocelyn Kehdi has agreed to consult for the ministry, train on-site managers, and facilitate the national campaign.
It's my role to support the government. It's my role to support the people. So if the ministry is going to be doing a national cleanup, it's my duty to make sure that it's the most sustainable practice possible.
Lucien Bourgeli, a theater and film director, became an activist in 2015, organizing the Youth Stink movement and getting arrested for a sit-in in the Ministry of Environment.
The ministry is not an NGO. The ministry is the executive body. It puts and implements policies. It's a hypocrisy. If you can apply laws and really manage to find a sustainable and long-term solution for this crisis, you do not go and make campaigns just to feel good. We want to clean all the beaches, including the ones they are polluting now, today.
He talks about waste dumps, Costa Brava and Burshamut, opened as temporary solutions where the government piles rubbish directly on the seafront.
If we clean the beach today, tomorrow it will be filled with garbage again because they're gonna dump back thousands of tons of trash in sea dumps that are going back to the sea, and the sea is bringing back the garbage to the seashore and to the beaches.
Environment Minister Fadish Rezati disagrees and says the landfill is the best solution to deal with the existing waste.
What's wrong with a sanitary landfill? It's totally isolated from the sea. It's the location that is bad, it's next to the sea, but it's totally isolated. It's a sanitary landfill.
The solution posed by the minister further relies on the landfills and incinerators. His advisor says,
okay, first of all, we need the highest amount of recycling. And then when we go to the final solution after recycling, whether we're talking incinerators or whether we're talking sanitary landfills, both should be discussed in a scientific way because there is no way to make garbage disappear.
While incinerators are criticized for releasing toxic smoke, activist Jocelyn continues to organize cleanups, asking people to recycle and prevent waste.
So this gives us, as a practical exercise, a way to look at our waste, look at our consumption, look at what needs to be redesigned, and use it as a practical example to show the government, look at all the people loving Lebanon and ready and able to come and mobilize.
For DW, I'm Julia Neumann in Beirut.
From sandy beaches, we now move to sand mines in Kenya. East Africa's population is on the rise. It's expected to nearly double in the next 3 decades, growing to 870 million. With this many more people comes the need for more homes, more roads, shops, places to eat, essentially more of everything. As the construction industry booms in East Africa, so does the demand for building materials. Andrew Wasike has more on how efforts to keep up with rising populations is placing a heavy burden on one of the Earth's most ubiquitous resources, sand.
The Kenyan capital of Nairobi, like most African cities, is constantly under construction, expanding to accommodate a rapidly growing population. With this construction boom, sand and cement are regularly used for their durability and low cost. But unsustainable mining practices of these specific types of sand, as well as limestone for cement, destroys ecosystems like rivers and beaches, killing plant and animal life both in the water and on land. Recent regulation of the sector has led to widespread illegal sand mining. I visited a large-scale sand mining site near the Athi River and witnessed firsthand the destructive force of the practice on the natural environment. Locals here complain of silicosis, sand in the lungs that can lead to tuberculosis and lung cancer. Lois Nduta is concerned about what the mining is putting into the air.
It's really affecting us in terms of health-wise. Like right now, you can feel the air is not even, it's very choking and you can't see any fume. The air we breathe, it's what concerns us. The air our kids breathe, we are concerned about our health.
Sand mining here has affected the ecological balance of the area. The mining has diminished natural resources. For example, depletion of sand in the streambed and along coastal areas has caused the rivers and estuaries to deepen and enlarged the mouths of rivers and coastal inlets, reducing the amount of water because less sand also means less water storage capacity in rivers. Underground aquifers and streams are now exposed to direct sun, heat, and wind, which increases water evaporation and reduces available supply of water. In the town of Makueni, I met Caroline Mueni as she was collecting murky water from a dry riverbed. She says that since the sand miners came, the water disappeared.
We have always had plenty of water to drink here, but since the lorries started coming here to mine the sand, we started facing water shortages all year round. Back then, we used to plant beans, among other crops, using the water from this river. Even our livestock used to drink here. We had no problems. We don't know where we will get water from. We had another big river on the other side, but now it is already being used by sand harvesters. Our village elders, our chiefs, are telling us that we would rather get money from the river than using the river as a water source.
The coastal areas of Kenya are known to be extremely valuable, habitats which are now threatened by growing megacities. Marine scientists like Dan Obura have been monitoring the effects of the sand mining activities in the area. He is worried about its effects on the flora and fauna in Kwale County along the Kenyan coast. He says that coral reefs in Kenya are being damaged and fish breeding grounds are being destroyed.
We saw that a huge amount of silts had been deposited in the reef. This was adjacent to the area where they had been harvesting the most intensively. The silt that is suspended in the water from doing the sand harvesting activities can smother corals, can smother the algae. It gets in the way of fish for feeding, for their vision and communication and what they do. So it can kill a reef. It can definitely cause a huge amount of damage on the scale at which it's being done.
The Kenya Pipeline Authority has ships dredging Kenya's Indian Ocean to harvest sand as close as 100 meters from the land. Locals like Edwin Carlon worry that the savage harvesting is affecting them and killing the ocean.
During the process of sand harvesting, as they bring the sand into the dredging ships, the whole peaceful and serene ocean water turns into a dust field. The sand is so thick that even fishermen who use spears, they can't see a thing. When it comes to tourists, those who go scuba diving see nothing. They don't see the beautiful exotic fish. They don't see the corals which are buried in sand. Our ocean is dying rapidly.
When I tried to reach Kenya Ports Authority on whether they were aware of these impacts, the environmental consultant Michael Okumu said that for a new berth and terminal they are constructing, they need about 3.5 million cubic meters of sand, which he said they mined from the deep sea. He agreed that sometimes the activities damage the corals.
Paramount is, what is the impact if you're working very close to the coral? If you are working and you manage to mitigate any of your impacts, you can proceed. But if we feel that if you're working close to the coral and there is an impact, then you need to move away.
The UN has urged world governments to cut consumption of sand and gravel by reducing overbuilding and using recycled and alternative materials. The goal of this strategy is to reduce unnecessary construction and avoid the use of cement and concrete where possible, so that demand for natural sand is reduced to responsible levels. As for sand alternatives, experts encourage green concrete formed from bottom ash or fly ash concrete, which is a byproduct of burning coal and offers an energy-saving substitute to cement in concrete mixes. The Sand and Sustainability Report for 2019 has also called for reusing waste on construction sites. Andrew Wasike for DW in Nairobi.
Have you ever been in a beautiful destination like Venice, trying to snap a photo of your surroundings, only to be blocked by a towering cruise ship? All around the Mediterranean, ports are struggling to cope with a growing number of cruise liners. In an industry unlikely to slow down anytime soon, residents concerned about cruise ships' environmental impacts are looking for different ways to get the problem under control. Tassilo Forheimer brings us this report from Italy, which is narrated by Irene Quayle.
The cruise ship industry is booming. In just 8 years' time, about 500 more floating hotels will be traveling across our oceans. 25 new ships are expected to make their maiden voyage this year alone. And the ships have been getting bigger and bigger in recent years. The impacts are particularly being felt in Italy, says Francesco Di Maio, the head of the port of Civitavecchia.
Last year, in 2018, we had around 12 million cruise ship passengers. Of those, about 25% come to Civitavecchia.
That makes the port of Civitavecchia, located just northwest of Rome, the largest cruise hub in Italy by far. Di Maio also expects annual growth of 5 to 10% in the coming years. Even now, there are sometimes as many as 8 cruise ships docked in the harbour. That means 30,000 passengers and 8,000 crew members at a time. The city itself only has about 50,000 residents. That doesn't mean that Civitavecchia receives a massive rush of visitors, though. Most tourists drive straight from here to Rome, says city councillor Dario Mendito.
Only a small percentage of the people who arrive here come to the city centre and support the local economy. The stream of tourists essentially just flows through here without anyone staying behind.
But from an ecological point of view, a different picture emerges.
A few years ago, a study was published stating that around 50% of the city's pollution comes from the port.
A lot of this has to do with cruise ships, which burn dirty fossil fuels during laytime to meet their high electricity needs. Proponents of the cruise ship industry say it's simply the price to be paid for all the jobs that it brings to Italy. Nationwide, some 4,000 people are employed by the cruise ship industry. The big ships bring work. But Dario Mendito isn't convinced.
Clearly, the ships create jobs, but it's still not enough considering the environmental impact. I don't think it's worth it.
Anna Gerometta, who's part of a citizens' initiative for cleaner air in Italian cities, agrees. The biggest problem areas are the port cities, where there are a particularly large number of cruise ships. She reckons this is because it's such an affordable form of tourism.
Usually, it's also cheap tourism. These trips cost very little, and tourists often have no money to spend on the mainland.
In order to keep tour prices low, many shipping companies use extremely low-quality fuels, which harm both the residents of port cities and the environment.
A team of epidemiologists carried out a study in Civitavecchia, which revealed that those living no more than 500 meters away from the port are 31% more likely to suffer from lung tumors. The statistics for those who die from neurological diseases is even higher, at 51%. It's such a big increase because the fuels they are using are very dirty.
But as far as Harbour Chief Di Maio is concerned, Civitavecchia is in the clear. According to measurements, the city is within the safety limits of the European Union.
There's no danger in the harbour right now. But that doesn't mean we can relax. We are very committed as a port authority to promoting environmentally friendly technology.
For example, a ferry has recently been operating between Barcelona and Civitavecchia, which only runs on low battery power when it's in port. Eco-friendly cruise ships could also be rewarded with cheaper rates.
The shipping company and the ship owners can be offered a reduction in the tariffs that they must pay for their waste when they enter the harbour. The tariff is reduced, for example, when they use electricity or liquefied natural gas.
Liquefied natural gas, or LNG, is increasingly being offered to shipping companies as an environmentally friendly alternative.
This is great for us, of course, because finally we're seeing development that is also environmentally friendly.
LNG produces 99% less particulate matter and a quarter less CO2. Compared with the heavy fuel oil which is still widely used today, this is a big step forward. But environmentalists like Anna Gerometta aren't so pleased with this development. She believes it would be much better to run the old ships using clean diesel and filters, while also ensuring that the port facilities are electrified so that the ship's engines don't have to keep running while they're docked. Anna thinks continuing to use fossil fuels, even those claimed to be more environmentally friendly, is the wrong path.
Del quale poi non ci libereremo così facilmente.
These ships are in operation for 30 to 40 years. If we really want to stop using fossil fuels, we need to start relying on electric propulsion, solar power and hydrogen.
Sul sole, sull'idrogeno.
But most cruise ships in the Mediterranean are still a long way from that. They will face tougher restrictions from next year. However, these will still be significantly more lenient than in most parts of northern Europe.
Irene Quayle presented that piece with reporting by Tassilo Forkheimer. We heard from my colleague Tim Schauenberg a few weeks ago while he was on board one of the most renowned scientific icebreakers in the world, the Polar Stern. On a voyage from Antarctica to the German port of Bremerhaven, the ship's team of scientists and students are trying to gain a better understanding of why water temperatures are rising in the depths of the ocean. The students, all talented scientists themselves, are learning how to monitor changes in the ocean and the climate. These are methods they can take back to their home countries, places that are already feeling the impacts of climate change. Here's Tim Schauenberg with this report from the open ocean.
In the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, the Polar Stern slows and comes to a halt. The giant research vessel is swaying in the waves off the east coast of Africa. All around, there's nothing but the deep blue sea. 21. While the midday sun is blazing outside, a group of students is standing around a wide laboratory bench inside the research boat, a microscope to their right, a filter machine to their left. Vincent Scholz, a young German who studies microbiology at the University of Aarhus in Denmark, is busy arranging small plastic bottles and sticking numeric codes onto them.
We're just making sure that everything is labeled correctly, so that when the CTD comes out, we have everything ready to sample.
CTD, that's the name for a key piece of equipment that measures connectivity, temperature and depth underwater. It's big as an airplane turbine and has sturdy steel bottles attached to it. Today is the day when the students get to put the CTD into the water. Vincent is one of 23 students from 20 countries who are part of the South-North Atlantic Transition Transect, a sort of elite summer school for upcoming young scientists who are really into studying the ocean. 800 students applied to be part of the mission. Marissa Naidu from South Africa is one of the few who got selected.
These bottles are used to collect samples from the CTD, which is taking water from different depths. So we have measurements like pH that we will quantify, gases such as oxygen. We'll look at the salinity. It'll also take measurements for temperature.
Data that could give an insight into climate change. The students are being led by a team of renowned scientists from Ireland, Portugal, New Zealand, Germany and South Africa. And today is a very exciting day for them, says Vincent.
We have seen a few CTDs going up and down, but always watching, and now it's us doing the action. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Cool. I'm excited!
One, two, three.
The students divide up the tasks via a game of paper, scissors, rock. Who gets to drive the device onto the deck? Who gets to give instructions to the crew? Who gets to monitor the measurement? Then their moment has come. Slowly and carefully, the CTD is driven onto the deck. A crane lifts the device over the ship's rail, then it disappears in the ocean, leaving a trail of bubbles behind. The device will take water samples as deep as 4,800 meters and bring them back to the surface. Only a few weeks ago, the Polar Stern was on a mission in the Antarctic, braving ice and exploring little-known ocean volcanoes. Now the icebreaker is crossing the entire Atlantic Ocean for 4 weeks and a total of 13,000 kilometers all the way to her home port in Bremerhaven, Germany. For the students and researchers, That means a trip on board the most famous German research boat ever.
It's one of the best ships with the best crew for really long distances.
That's Karen Wiltshire, expedition leader and vice director of the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research, which is conducting the expedition. The Polarstern is packed with containers holding lab equipment and technical devices. But the mission isn't just about doing the research, it's also about teaching students. Wiltshire says the boat is a place
where people get a chance to actually work with the medium that they're interested in, understand how it's linked to the atmosphere, how everything works together, how our ocean functions.
It's important to understand the ocean in order to fight global warming, she adds. The Earth has already warmed by an average of 1 degree Celsius, the ocean by 0.8 degrees. When the ocean heats up, it expands. The result? A rise in sea levels. And a warmer ocean can also absorb less energy from the atmosphere, which means the land is getting warmer as well. Peter Lemke, polar researcher and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, says industrial countries are especially to blame.
We started changing the climate 150 years ago and are still doing it by emitting CO2. And of course we have to do something in order to prevent that. And we can only do that together.
That's why priority was given to upcoming researchers from developing countries that are already feeling the impact of climate change. Filenaina Lantovololonas from Madagascar is one of them.
People have to move in toward the land, yeah, to escape from a flood and escape from storms.
Only last year in Madagascar, 15,000 people were displaced by a tropical storm and subsequent landslides. A warmer ocean means more water evaporates and tropical storms become more likely. In a room with a clear view of the working deck and the crane, Peter Crute, an oceanographer from the National University of Ireland, is monitoring green and blue curves on a screen. This is the data that the measuring device has transmitted from under the water to the computer. Crute is surrounded by curious students.
Well, we know that in this area, some of the intermediate waters have warmed over the last 20 to 30 years. So we would expect to see a continuation of that.
The temperature at 2,400 meters depth is currently 2.4 degrees Celsius. Whether that is more or less than in the past will become apparent when the numbers are compared to the ones from previous years. The measuring device has reached the surface again, dripping. The students quickly remove the water samples from the deep sea and carry them to the laboratories, where they'll be examined. It will take a while until the results are in, but for Filenaina, one thing is already clear. The fight against global warming means the protection of the oceans.
I truly want to share to my compatriots that there's a lot that we can do.
The ship re-embarks on its voyage. It will stop at another two measuring stations and take another 6 days until it reaches shore in Bremerhaven. The meteorologist on board is forecasting calm seas for the coming days, bright and sunny. Perfect timing, because it's not just work and research on this Polarstern trip. Tonight, the crew is throwing a barbecue for the whole ship, surrounded by nothing but the deep blue sea. For DW, I'm Tim Schaumberg.
For more of Tim's reporting from the Polarstern, visit our website, dw.com/environment. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. If you have a question or comment for us, you can get in touch by emailing us at livingplanet@dw.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Planet wherever you listen to podcasts. And consider recommending us to a friend. Or you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Our studio manager this week was Ileana Ghilarducci. Christoph Groove was our studio technician. Irene Quill and Charlie Shield helped with production. And I'm Sam Baker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more environment stories from around the globe.